man.
Oh, girl.
Oh, boy.
Oh, woman.
Oh, people.
Oh, people.
I am so full of stir fry. It is wonderful.
Oh, my God. I actually can't move.
Yeah. Welcome to Extraneous.
We have extra stir fry. Welcome to Extraneous, His Dark Materials, mm-hmm. where we are deep into Amber Spyglass already, chapters 5 and 6. We have so much to do. Okay. Summary time.
Are you ready?
I think so. I don't know.
All right. On the clock, go.
So Baruch tries to get to Asriel, but Asriel's people get him only after he's been savaged by rival angels. He gets brought in to talk to Asriel, tells him all about Will and Lyra. Asriel, meanwhile, has learned that Lyra is important, but he can't conceive of why. But now Asriel knows about the knife, so watch out. We also meet the Gallivespians, who are one of them is Asriel's head of strategy. They're these little tiny creature people. We'll talk about them later. Mm-hmm. The angel tells Asriel where Mrs. Coulter and Lyra are, and they make a plan to go and get her, but they can't get the exact location out of the angel before Baruch dies because somebody opened a door too fast. Then meanwhile, in the church, in the other, with all the incels, Father MacPhail, who is the president of the Consistorial Court of Discipline, are working with this other part of the church, or working against this other part of the church, to get all the information they need. They have finally found out that Lyra is known as Eve, and they also know about the knife, and they make a plan to kill Lyra. They activate the Terminator, aka Father Gomez, who has been doing penance basically all his life so that he could build up credit so that if he had to murder a child, that would be fine.
Yeah.
The end.
Under 2 minutes. Let's say you're under two minutes.
Those are big chapters.
Yeah. That's a lot.
I'm not mad about that.
Yeah, you did well.
Okay. All right. So shall we start with our characters?
Yeah.
Let's start with Baruch.
Baruch.
Oh, Baruch.
Yeah. We don't learn a lot more about Baruch.
No.
It's just, he's, what a hero, man.
What a hero. The way that he dies, he can't hold his atoms together.
Yeah.
And then the door opens. It's nobody's fault. Nobody gets mad. But the door opened too fast and his atoms just flew apart. That's wild. What a way to go.
It's wild. And we'll talk more about this, but I just love the synergy with the way demons are described as disappearing at the moment of death. It's like, it's the same idea, because it's like demons are dust the way angels are dust.
Yeah. They're like, they're pure dust.
Yeah.
So they're trying to hold themselves together. They are just basically all demon. Here's the thing. Is a bear the opposite of an angel? They have no demon. They don't show their emotions. They're all earth. They're all present.
Yes.
So then if an angel is all demon dust, and they're all emotion, and all... They do seem to be very emotional beings. Every angel we meet is like full of rage or love or sarcasm or, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, just a little side thought.
Baruch, he has this beautiful line where someone says, "You flew quickly." I think Asriel said he's marveling at how quickly he flew across this vast distance.
Across the world.
Yeah, multiple worlds. Mm-hmm. And he says, "It is referring to his swiftness. It is the only gift I have except the love of Balthamos, whom I shall never see again."
That really sucks. I also love the description of the fight between him and the rival angels, the entities that are sort of chasing each other over this lake of sulfur. It's very cool.
It's very cool. It's totally Miltonian. Also, it's right out of Milton.
Also, hey, Baruch, he was 4-on-1.
Yeah.
And two of them went down.
Right. And the other two never emerged from the...
Well, it took two of them chasing him, and then two of them...
Yeah, two of them never came out of the cloud.
Two of them never came out of the cloud, mm-hmm. and the other two he got away from.
Yeah. It's like Wash and Firefly.
Definitely.
Right?
I am a beautiful bird on the wind, or leaf whatever on the wind.
Yeah, yeah.
But he got there. He delivered his message. He got them close enough to where there's a mountain in the Himalayas. There's a shrine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he really did. Yeah, he did his job. I mean, the amount of like massive exposition that this angel delivers in a couple minutes, it's wild.
And you know that at that very moment, Balthamos can feel it. Yeah. Knows what's happened.
Totally. Poor Balthamos. Poor Baruch. Poor everyone, man. And I think it's significant that Asriel changes his entire plan. And this is like Asriel. He's got countless armies waiting on him and moving in one direction. And then he just changes it all.
Well, when you find a knife that can cut through anything and kill God, you get there in a hurry.
we should talk about, man, this guy, he's been Asriel? Dominating the conversation. Yeah. Asriel.
Dude has built himself a fortress out of something. I don't know how to say this word. Bath salts.
Oh, bath salts.
Fortress out of bath salts.
Basalt. I have no idea. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a little geology minute here.
We have a geologist friend.
I happen to have a geologist sister. Here at Extraneous, we want to bring you nothing but the facts. So we are going to, this is like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or something.
We're calling a family member.
Okay.
I mean, what do you mean? It's our geologist on call.
Our geologist. This is a...
Hello?
Hi, Julia.
Hi.
We now have on the line noted geologist, Julia Redden.
Geologist of the pod.
Geologist of the pod.
Maybe some nepotism going on.
tiny bit. It's fine. It's
possible.
What good is having a geologist in the family if you can't That's use right. it?
Finally, you could give back to this family, Julia.
That's what I'm saying.
All right. So Jules.
Yeah.
We have some questions about
bath salts.
About basalts. First of all, how do you say this word?
Basalt.
Basalt. Oh, it sounds good when she
like
does it.
Like assault, but with a B.
Two peanuts walked down the street and one was basalted.
Oh, boy.
So what can you tell us about basalt? Basalt.
Basalt facts.
Yeah.
Say it with confidence, Will.
Basalt.
So basalt is actually, there's a lot to know about it. It's the actually the most common bedrock found on Earth. And that's largely thanks to it being what makes up the oceanic plates. So there's the continental plates for if you want to go really deep in geology, but
right.
The tectonic plates is what the Earth's crust is made out of, and you have the oceanic plates, and you have the continental plates, and the oceanic plates are mostly made of basalt, and they're actually the heavier of the two types of plates as well. So whenever you have where the two plates come together, if it's a continental plate and an oceanic plate, the oceanic plate will dive below the continental plate because it's more dense.
Oh.
And so that's what's happening on the California coast, where it's a convergent plate boundary. So that's how you get the ring of fire all around the Pacific.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
That's wild. And that's basalt.
Basalt.
Yes. Yep.
It's literally yep. what the world is made of.
Yeah.
It's a mafic rock. So there's two types of, and that's rocks. There's mafic and felsic, and that's based on the chemical composition. Mafic rocks tend to be darker in color and more dense, like I just mentioned with the oceanic crust. And that means that they're higher in iron and magnesium versus felsic are lighter colors. And they have more potassium and feldspar and larger amounts of quartz versus mafic has smaller amounts of quartz.
So if you were to build a fortress that God himself couldn't penetrate, what type of basalt would you want to make sure it was made out of?
Well,
or would you choose a different rock? We'll throw that as a second part question. Is basalt what you're going with here?
Are we talking just like I'm just going to carve out a piece of rock and then put it as a wall? I mean, I would want to use concrete.
that's fair. I'm not sure if Lord Asriel has access to the mixing compounds, but that's a fair comment.
Yeah. I want to switch gears here and talk about sulfur. What do you know about liquid sulfur?
I know it smells like rotten eggs.
Okay.
Sulfur, at least.
Yeah.
That's all I know about sulfur, too.
Yeah, same.
Does anyone know anything else about sulfur? It stinks.
Yellow.
Yellow, okay, yeah.
The yellow color.
It's also a gas. Is sulfur in this chapter?
Oh, well, there's the lake of liquid sulfur that the angel dies in.
Delightful.
Yeah.
I have one more for you to throw. I'm going to throw a quick one at our geologist. Adamant. Is that a real thing? Or lodestone? I think lodestone's mythical.
I don't recognize it.
Yeah.
I think they're fake.
I do not know every single rock in the world.
How dare you? How dare?
My fault. Shortcomings.
All right. Well,
faults. That's a geology joke.
If I got to choose between basalt and silver, I would definitely choose basalt.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
Julia, we appreciate it. This has been a Geology Minute with Julia Redden, noted geologist.
Noted geologist. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can I say one thing about Azriel?
No. I'm kidding. What?
It's nice to see him.
It is nice to see him.
We haven't seen him in a while.
We haven't. Yeah, he like sat out the whole second book. And this would have been, I missed that episode. I wish they had done the Azriel episode. I'm so sad about it.
I know. It's just, you know, the guy who's on, everybody's talking about for 3 books now, he's finally on screen.
He's back.
It's wild. It's cool.
It really is.
And he doesn't disappoint. At one point, one of the Galavespians, Lord Roke, who we're
Lord
about to
Roke,
talk to.
That's his head of strategy.
He says something like kind of dismissive to Azriel about his daughter. And
I love it.
He gives him this look that the force of Lord Azriel's glance flicked him like a finger, which is a big deal if you're a Galavespian.
Yeah.
So that he lost his balance and had to put out a hand to steady himself on Lord Azriel's wine glass.
I love it. I love that Azriel loses his composure for a second because you can't tell the whole first book and obviously the whole second book if he really loves Lyra or not. And if you've read the prequels, you can get more of an idea, but you really think that both of these parents really don't have a lot of love in their heart for her, but there are these little moments and they're awesome.
Yeah, I mean, Azriel's feelings are complicated. Just to think about Azriel as this like powerful, violent person. Because we get a lot about Lord Roke. He's haughty, he's arrogant, he's angry at everybody. Like, he's very hard to scare. Yeah. And Azriel just looks at him and he literally physically falls over.
I mean, but I'm not talking about he's got this like sweet, gushy love for his daughter. He just very clearly has powerful feelings for her if it could make him break his composure. He didn't even break his composure when the person accidentally killed the angel. Literally turned around and said, "It's not your fault. Let's move." But this makes him flicker.
And then there's this bit related to that point. He's talking about the end of the first book. She came to me on Svalbard and I ignored her. I didn't consider her after that, not for a moment.
Doing things. He doesn't consider her for a moment because he's out to kill the authority. He's on the biggest thing of his life. And yeah, he's complicated. He clearly has strong feelings for his daughter, but he has put her aside because he doesn't see her as significant and he needs to do what he's doing.
It is telling in this sort of moral universe that Philip Pullman is creating that the book really seems to have a little bit of judgment for people who take this like, I don't have time to do the good thing in front of me. I'm like subject to bigger forces. I'm doing more important things. There's bigger things going on than, you know, being nice to my daughter, you know, as opposed to the Yorks and the Lee Scoresbys of the world who are like, you do the thing that's right and you do it in front of the Amas of the world.
Right.
Even if it's small.
Right. In this chapter, it finally looks like a fair fight between him and the authority. Once we know what we know about the authority now, which is that he is the first angel and he's old and decrepit and has been hiding in the clouded mountain and is really the real seat of power is the Metatron. It does, when you think about Azriel versus the oldest angel, it's a whole lot more real than Azriel versus actual God,
right, which you would assume has some level of omnipotence where we see an angel die in this room and it doesn't take much to do it.
Suddenly it's just two powerful people who've ranged a lot of other powerful entities and people to their side, as opposed to Menelamancha.
Yeah, you got that.
The idyllic and Manichaean effort to kill God just sounds so impossible, and it is impossible until this quirk happens where it's like, well, he's called God. That's like his stage name.
Right.
But
he plays it on TV.
He's really just a bunch of atoms that are trying very hard to stay together, and he's in a glass coffin and it's fine. Metatron's who you have to go after.
Yeah. And Metatron we've seen is a force, but you know, the way Azriel's palace and armies are described here, Azriel seems like a force. He seems like a worthy force. Like this is a real fight.
And he rules with clarity of knowledge and sharing knowledge and sharing strategy and bringing people in, and the authority rules by keeping people out and being secretive and bringing the clouds around him. Maybe that's the difference between the clouded mountain and the tower of basalt, as we now know we call it. Maybe that's the idea. He's building something literally out of the earth that is obvious to anyone who looks at it. It is what it is. It is not pretending to be anything else. And the clouded mountain is a moving target of sky that the authority doesn't want anybody to have any visibility on.
So I think that's Ezreal for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get back to him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll have more to say.
Lord Roke. Let's talk about Lord Roke.
Yeah.
Every time I read the series, I get to the Galavespians and I go, ugh, the Galavespians, these little dragonfly little guys. And then by the end of the Galavespians' journey, I'm like, Galavespians, like wiping tears. And this is, I had that same feeling. I'm like, oh, Lord Roke, you haughty little blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
All right. Who's Lord Roke?
The spy captain was called Lord Roke. He was striking to look at. He was no taller than Lord Asriel's hand span, and as slender as a dragonfly, but the rest of Lord Asriel's captains treated him with profound respect, for he was armed with a poisonous sting in the spurs on his heels. It was his custom to sit on the table, and his manner to repel anything but the greatest courtesy with a haughty and malevolent tongue. He and his kind, the Galavespians, had few of the qualities of good spies, except, of course, their exceptional smallness. They were so proud and touchy that they would never have remained inconspicuous if they had been of Lord Asriel's size.
I mean, a malevolent tongue? That's a hell of a way to describe a sensible protagonist. Not protagonist, but like on the good guy's side.
Hey, listen, good guys need malevolent tongues also.
It's yeah.
Really good band name.
Lord Roke and the Malevolent Tongues. He's a spy captain. This is really interesting. I love the bit about... he doesn't act like he has no qualities that a spy would have except the fact that he's really small.
Right, right. If he was the size of Lord Asriel, forget it.
Yeah,
he's too haughty.
Not quiet.
He doesn't like anything but the greatest courtesy. You have to be really, he's really precious, is what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very good at what they do because they are so small. They, meaning his, I guess, partner. I guess we know they're partners at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's a republic, so the hierarchies are loose. I just want to say, Lord Roke seems like he has Asriel's seriousness of purpose. He seems like a good guy to have on your corner if you're actually serious about pulling off something like storming heaven, you know?
Right.
He's like a no bullshit. This is what needs to happen. He's clearly like brave and forceful and focused. And he's going to, everyone who's under him, is going to do what they're expected to do because he cares and he's paying attention. He just seems like a good general, like a General Patton type.
Do you think they look small and human-like, or do you think... I think they do. I think they look small and human-like.
I think they look vaguely human-like.
But
they're humanoid.
I always think they're dragonflies because the ones that we spend more time with fly dragonflies.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to remind myself that no, they look like little people.
Yeah, they do. But they're blue.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of little people.
So Lord Roke also flies on a little hawk.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious because proportionally he would be flying on Drogon.
Right, exactly.
He's flying a dragon. So the other Galavespian that we hear of is Lady Salmakia. So Lady Salmakia, who has tricked a member of the Society of Holy Spirit into thinking that she's a spirit of wisdom. She basically did a Bloody Mary on the Society of Holy Spirit. It's pretty genius.
I love this. This is right out of the Americans or something.
Uh-huh,
it's
absolutely.
Like she did a little operation and now she's got this guy in the Society of the Holy Spirit. We're just going through. There's so many new characters.
There's so many new characters and they're all important.
Yeah, it all matters. These are dense chapters. So the next guy we got to talk about is Metatron.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've mentioned Metatron. We've touched on like the fact that he is not in the Bible, but he's like a biblical figure. There's a million representations of him in pop culture. This Metatron, we get like a full
bio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So first of all, he's Baruch's brother.
So are all angels brothers?
Yeah.
Is that what this is?
Yeah.
You know, brothers, sisters, whatever. that's what I took that to be. He was once my brother. But we take into account Baruch
was human.
Was human 4,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And as we've discussed, and Metatron was made regent 4,000 years ago. So are Baruch and Bathalmos of just like they went to the other side, basically. They were rebel angels and Metatron was the subservient. He just went in the other direction. You can almost do the origin story of the moment they split.
Yeah.
And a 4,000 years ago could have been not at the same time. Like just that, it just seems like he doesn't say 4,000 years ago about two different entities on accident.
Mm-hmm. And we learned that Metatron used to be called Enoch.
Enoch.
Son of Jared, son of Mahalel.
Is that relevant in any way?
I mean, Enoch, I think, is a prophet of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And I think he might have been... Remember when we talked about Baruch, I said that like there's some prophets that like were taken up to heaven directly sure. by God. And one of them was in a chariot of fire. And I thought it was Elijah, but it might have been Enoch.
But so do we think that Baruch and Enoch were taken in at the same time or walked into heaven 4,000 years ago?
I mean, if they were brothers and we know that Baruch was taken in 4,000 years ago, I assume. But then this is where this gets tricky because A, we know that Enoch, he's described as saying he was a lover of the flesh. He had many wives. Mm-hmm. So he was like not a very godly person. He's described in the Old Testament of the Bible as like Enoch who walked with God and then was taken up by God or something like that. So him being a sinner is, I don't think, in the Bible. I think this is a little confused because like he was a human and then he was promoted directly from human to regent angel.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Good. Nice job. Somebody did some good sucking up in the staff room is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So this is a little muddy, you know, and that's okay. It's not super important, but I think it's significant just because this is an example of Metatron is like overcompensating for his own previous sinfulness mm-hmm. and humanity and all that. Yeah. And now he's like the most diehard.
He's just ruthless. He just wants the power. He wants to be the authority. And, you know, he essentially is the authority at this point.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, moving right along.
Back to the church. Back to the magisterium.
Yeah.
However, this person that we're about to meet for the first time in the books, we've actually known him from the first part of the series. So it's really weird because I now have him intercut in my head with the beginning of the television show, mm-hmm. aka the beginning of Golden Compass. And really, this is the first time we're meeting him.
Yeah, exactly. It seems wild that we're this deep into the story. I agree. I had the same thought that it was like, wow, I could have sworn that we've been with Father MacPhail for a long time. But we have not. So our guy here, Hugh MacPhail. He's Scottish. He's in his 40s.
Is it Scottish when it's spelled M-A-C and Irish when it's spelled M-C? Did I read that someplace?
Well, the Irish word Mac actually means son of in both Scots and Irish.
I know that's what that implicates, but I thought M-A-C was Scottish and M-C was Irish.
You know, in my head, I'm going over examples that...
McCallum, McFadden.
Yeah, McDougal,
McLoyn.
Man, we're going to have to say consistorial court of discipline a lot, and that's a mouthful.
Consistorial was a good word. What does consistorial mean?
It means having to do with a consistory.
Well, gee.
Which is...
What's a consistory?
Gang, it's in our outline.
Oh, it's we're in just the outline. That's just sexy AF right
down
there.
Down here. Here we go. Bullet point 4.
Governing council of a church. Relating to the governing council of the church. RE disciplinary matters.
Mm-hmm.
What do they mean?
I think they mean like the Inquisition.
Yeah, basically. Kind of. Okay, let's get back to MacPhail. We'll get back to the consistorial.
Yeah.
Back to Father MacPhail, Hugh MacPhail, Huge Fail. His name is Huge Fail.
Yeah.
He's in his 40s. He's going to serve for, he's basically
serves
Clarence
for life.
Thomas over here.
Yeah.
He will be shaping the court for years and years and years to come. It's actually what they say.
Yeah, really.
We'll mold the destiny of the consistorial court for many years to come. Nothing in the books about Mrs. Coulter helping him rise to power. So that's just a television invention.
Yep.
He was a dark-featured man, tall and imposing, with a shock of wiry grey hair, and he would have been fat were it not for the brutal discipline he imposed on his body. He drank only water and ate only bread and fruit, and he exercised for an hour daily under the supervision of a trainer of champion athletes. As a result, he was gaunt and lined and restless. His demon was a lizard.
He's a lunatic.
He's a lunatic. Yeah.
He's a QAnon theorist, basically. he's a strict interpretationalist, but on the loony side of strict interpretation.
Like right? An originalist.
Yeah, but I even hate. I mean, I know what it like colloquially means, but the way these people they call themselves originalists, but are specious and selective originalists. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to talk about. Homosexuality being a sin in the Bible, but nothing else that's a sin in the Bible, like the threads and all those other, you know, so he's a selective originalist, we'll say, or he is a hypocrite. There's just a one word for it, and it's hypocrite. Mm-hmm.
He's a hypocrite, sure. But he is also a true believer.
There's a lot of people who are true believers that are also not hypocrites.
Yeah, well, is he a hypocrite, though? I mean,
all these people who think that it's okay to kill a child are hypocrites. That you can build up a store of penance so that you can kill a child and it's not even a murder. That's hypocrisy. Do not kill, but except for this time when we decided it would be okay if you just like beat yourself enough.
Mm-hmm. It is true zeal. I mean, it's zealotry. So yeah. It's,
I mean, it's like the authority is the only authority, except when we decide we want to make a rule that gets around what the authority says.
Sure.
It's rank hypocrisy.
Yeah, it reminds me of that line in Doubt where... somebody says, you take a step away from God, and Meryl Streep goes, yes, but in his service. It's like that idea of like, I'm doing it for God, even if I have to do ungodly things.
Yeah, that's absurd.
Yeah. Melissa isn't buying it, you guys.
I'm not about it.
The consistorial court of discipline will see you now.
Next character.
Okay.
Basil. Oh, Basil. That's what I'm going to call him.
Teuchron Basilides.
Just going to call him Basil.
Basil. Yeah, I like that.
Basil
T. Asriel's alethiometrist.
What a name.
There are hard things to say in this episode. There are.
It's like it's meant to be written.
Teuchron Basilides, the alethiometrist of Lord Asriel.
I like that he's this like kind of wispy man. He's pale and he's thin. His demon's a nightingale, which I kind of like as the implication of I tell stories, I sing. I find things that the world is telling me and I sing them.
Love it. Yeah, I agree. I like these little side characters. Like, how did Basil get to be in Asriel's service? How does Asriel even have an alethiometer?
You know how? Basil, he looked at Basil and he was like, your demon's a nightingale. It's not an insect. Maybe you're not the bad guy.
Oh, right. Yeah, maybe you can be on our side.
Maybe you can come and be on our side.
Is the magisterium just everyone who got picked last in kickball because they have like weird demons?
Incels.
Yeah. Yeah, this is... It's 4chan.
Yeah.
Or 8chan or whatever. Next up, speaking of 8chan.
Oh my God.
Oh man.
We got Q himself.
Yeah. McPhail was bad. Father Stephen Miller. Oh
God. It's so
pale and trembling with zealotry. Father Luis Stephen Miller Gomez.
Oh my goodness.
I have done preemptive penance every day of my life.
So this guy literally, okay, so he's like 40 or so.
Way younger than
he's
that.
He's younger. He's like 20,
he's
29,
the youngest member of the country. Yeah.
35.
Of the CCD.
We'll what do we want to describe? Oh, CCD was like where you learned Catholicism.
I know.
30. We'll call him 30.
I think he's like 24 or something.
Preemptive penance. Do you think he means every day of my life?
I think he was born to this, man. He was probably raised in the church. He probably, or I shouldn't say probably, it might make sense, but the way he's described, like he's just looking for it.
That is so sick. For him to mean it, it means his parents or whoever served as his parents. Maybe he was in an orphanage. Maybe he was raised by the church. Mm-hmm. It means that he had to basically be told and abused as a child, like not even just physically, but like saying, you are being raised to commit some great evil, so you better start making up for it now. And, you know, they mean physical abuse when they talk about preemptive penance.
Sure.
This is horrible. This is an actual horrible life. This guy is a psycho who has been raised literally to be a psycho.
Yeah, Father Luis Gomez sucks. he's going to assassinate Lyra. His demon is a large iridescent green beetle, like a scarab beetle kind of thing.
Again, am I the bad guy?
Yeah.
This is terrible, but this place is terrible. I imagine he's an orphan. I imagine that he was born to, like he was raised by these holy, quote unquote, holy people. Mm-hmm. And they told him, And they just saw him as here's a person we can start training to be a soldier that can commit some great evil for us. So we'll train him to, you know, physically abuse himself every day of his life so that he can believe that he can commit a horrific act and enter the quote unquote kingdom of God after doing so.
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome.
Also, what happens when they don't have a horrific evil for him to do? And he gets to like 95 years old and he's like, but I've been doing penance all my life.
Right.
Let me just kill someone. Just let me kill someone before I die. Is that what happens?
Yeah. So that's Father Luis Gomez. Unfortunately, it's not the last of him we will see. Next character is Chevalier Tialis.
Yeah. Gallivespian number three.
Number three.
And Chevalier is hiding in the rafters during a meeting of the Consistorial Court of Discipline. Yes.
Yeah.
That's all we get, really.
That's all we get. Yeah. And then he meets up with Lady Salmakia at the end of chapter 6, very briefly, and they have a chat. But we'll get there more on this guy to come. Yeah, you know, we've been dancing around with the characters. It's time to get into the big stuff. All right, first Dust Bear. Speaking of Gallivespians, it's the Gallivespians.
Just them as an entity?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're new and they will be very important.
They will.
They're small and proud and brave and spies. Yeah.
And they have poison on their heels.
They do. They have these little poison spurs. Spikes. Yeah.
Do you think it's like what they're wearing or do you think it's in their anatomy?
I think it's what they're wearing.
I think it's in their anatomy.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So you think they're more like stingers than spurs?
I think they are. I think it is stingers. I think they're like little bugs.
Yeah. You know, you might be right now because every single one has it. And it's not like they put them on in the morning, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And why would you be so scared of them? Because people are scared of them if you can, you know, take their shoes.
They only live 9 or 10 years on average. They have very quick childhoods and no old age. They die after a decade in the prime of their life.
That sucks.
And it is fascinating. It's such a wild detail. It's like,
well, when you know your life will end in the prime, maybe you're bred for a hard and fast life.
Yeah.
You have a short childhood. You go out in a blaze of glory because you're at the prime of your abilities. So why not just do something big and important? It feels right that they're spies.
It's just wild. It just like supercharges everything that the Gallivespians do every time they're on the page. Like the way demons kind of supercharge human relationships in this. And like every character matters because every character has a demon in these books. It's just like everything a Gallivespian does matter because they are allotted so few actions. There's so many delightful things that Philip Pullman just adds in these books just when you think you're done. So we have a few like big tentpole things here. I mean, we tried to break them up. We get thrown a lot of information in these chapters. Let's start talking about the prophecy as Fra Pavel tells us about it.
Fra Pavel, again, is the elite theometrist for the Magisterium. And he says, the child is in the position of Eve, the wife of Adam, the mother of us all, and the cause of all sin. Of course, you freaking flipping incel sons of... Okay. How many times can we call the Magisterium incel? Take a shot. So yeah, he says that if the child is tempted as Eve was, she's likely to fall.
Mm-hmm.
And they think she's gonna fall. So they decide to kill her. But they tell Father Gomez to go and find them, but not to look for the kids, to look for the tempter. Go and find the thing that will find them. Mm-hmm. And that is, all they know is that it's a female and she comes from a strange world. That's all Father Gomez gets.
Yeah.
Go after him. It's going to be weird. See you later.
Yeah, wild stuff. And if this temptation does take place and the child gives in, then dust and sin will triumph.
Yeah, dust and sin.
Yeah,
I'm on dust and sin side.
Yeah, I think we both are. Yeah, so that's the prophecy, and that's what Father Gomez is like. That's what's driving him. So he's off to look for the tempter, whoever she is.
I bet he's got an image in his head of who the tempter is and what the tempter looks like, and it's probably not Mary Malone.
Yeah, dead wrong.
He probably thinks it's, you know, like a snake charmer.
Salome or something.
Yeah, exactly.
No, exactly.
No.
So, Melissa, how often do we listen to podcasts?
Always. Like, Literally always.
Literally always. Yeah. Right. But how often do we listen to new podcasts?
Pretty much never.
Yeah, exactly. So it's so easy to fall into kind of a rut with pods because it's so hard to find great podcasts out of like the same old big name media companies who tend to dominate the content headlines, etc. That's why you need The Listener. It's an independent podcast recommendation service.
Yeah, The Listener delivers 3 podcast recommendations to your inbox every single day with representative episodes to get you hooked. These are actual independent productions and they're curated by an actual human, not an algorithm. Her name is Caroline Crampton, and she's a podcast industry expert who listens to hours and hours of content to find the best stuff.
As a paid subscriber, in addition to daily podcast recs, you get access to an RSS feed that delivers the recommendations directly into your podcast app of choice. So listen, go to thelistener.co and use checkout code STAYEXTRA20, that's STAYEXTRA20, all one word, for 20% off your first year of subscription.
I like how you did listen. Listen, go to The Listener.
And then listen some more.
All right, the situation in heaven.
The situation in heaven. It sounds like a book about something, right? Like a self-help book. Like,
yes, it does.
Yeah. The situation in heaven, learning about you
and business, me. A business help book.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
God is taking retirement, cashing in his vacation days, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he is moving.
God's done. God's done. God's like, I am going to Toby Ziegler this. I'm taking a step back. He's going to do Big Think while Metatron does the world stuff.
Right.
And is free to
the day-to-day.
Screw up the whole world and be a tin pot dictator. I guess not tin pot when you're talking about actual ruling the world. I guess
ruling from heaven itself.
I guess there's nothing tin pot about it. So Metatron is taking over operations, as it were.
He has big plans. They're terrible.
I have questions.
Yeah.
A permanent inquisition isn't the very nature of an inquisition, that there is something you are inquiring. Sort of the truth is in the explanation here. Mm-hmm. What are you inquiring? What are you trying to find out? The very nature of an inquisition is that there is an end at which you have inquired. But he's like,
right.
Nah, I think I'm going to be inquiring forever. I'm just curious. I'm just trying to put out ideas, trying to like, you know, disrupt this whole world thing.
I mean, it assumes the presence of heresy
forever.
And the necessity, yeah, forever. Yeah. So it's an attempt to stamp out heresy forever, but also like the assumption that that will never happen.
Right.
Basically, it just reveals what he envisions for the world.
It rips world. Any and all guys off this idea of the authorities' ilk having any notion of doing anything good for anyone ever and only in their power. I mean, the kinds of things you saw Trump starting to do. Starting to question anyone who questioned him, fire anyone who questioned him, make sure there is one way of thinking, and anyone who betrays the hint of anything against that must be acted against. Obviously, U.S. politics and the world is very, very different. But when you see that kind of activity, you know, the OAN reporter, not OAN, Voice of America reporter who questioned Mike Pompeo was swiftly reassigned. It's that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Though I think with Metatron, it's more like, you looked at me badly, you will be tortured forever.
It's like a little eternal different. Torture. It's
sort of at the extreme of the bell curve.
It answers the question that I think we've sort of danced around a little bit, which is like, are things so bad? Because obviously in Lyra's world, they are so bad. And they seem to be so bad because of the Magisterium. And I think there's been an open question about like, is the Magisterium like, is it just the Magisterium that sucks? Because like that's not operative in Will's world. Obviously, Will's world is our world where like there are religious fanatics and there are repressive societies, but it's not like the whole earth is ruled by this like repressive theocracy the way Lyra's world is.
It's hidden by the secularism and the notion of freedom.
Right. It's like it's not the Magisterium is not in control of Will's world. And I think there is I at least had questions of, is the authority so bad? Because like we've only seen a couple worlds, and of the worlds we've seen, only one of them is in the grip of the Magisterium. You know, right. Chitagate, they like overstepped and they basically had like a nuclear disaster.
Right.
You could almost call it with their experimentation. But just the very nature of that experimentation suggests that they also weren't in the grip of the Magisterium. So here we get, it's a separate conversation about how much accountability the Met, the authority, gets assigned to here over the events of this book. But we have a very clear big bad right now in Metatron, and like, he does have bad plans for the world, and it will affect all the different worlds that we see. So it like sets the stakes, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the question about Will's world is interesting, because it's not so bad, but like you said, it's setting the stakes. First of all, it's not so bad because the view we get to see is of Will, who is not in such dire straits, has a lot of privilege, lives in a free country, you know, all these things. Probably other pieces of the world in Will's world are really suffering under the, you know, religious fanaticism, which we know exists.
Will's world
is our world, right? So right. Like, so yeah. So that's the one reason it doesn't seem so bad. But this raises that stake, because what the authority is saying, well, if I win, all that goes away. Forget it. It is just pure power and no questioning of power from here on out. And you've seen what I'll do with that power, which is put you in a prison camp forever for no reason. It's dire. He almost undersells it, Philip Pullman. Like, doesn't dramatize very much just how bad this is until you get to the world of the dead.
It's true. Yeah. That there's this horrible reality that's facing every living thing for all time. Like, there's no escape. Like, almost every living creature that's ever existed for almost the entirety of their existence are in this like horrible nothingness. It's like if you looked at a pie chart, it would be like 99.8% of all of existence is just the underworld. And right? Because it's every person who's ever lived in every single world.
It's staggering. Yeah. It's a staggering, staggering figure. Also, just the logistics of it operationally, you have to set a way for every living being from every other world to enter this one world in a certain state after death. So I guess our question about what kind of powers the authority has and angels have, they do have some sort of power for traveling between worlds, even though we only see them do it through windows.
Yeah.
So maybe not all of them do, or maybe angels of the really high order do have the power. But if God, who is an angel, the authority, whoever, who is an angel, was able to set up, you know, set up the server framework here.
Yeah, no, exactly. Where they all feed into the same.
Yeah, he's basically a sysadmin. And it kind of answers a couple of questions about what kind of powers are possible through angels.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And you wonder if this is a total headcanon, but if like those powers have been reduced over time, because in the Bible, like, humanity used to live for like 500 years, and then that lifespan slowly shrunk and shrunk, you know, like Adam and Noah and all them lived for like centuries at a time. And like there were like old school prophets who would like talk directly to God, and all those powers, like quote unquote superpowers, have like atrophied over time. Mm-hmm. And you wonder if back in the very beginning, the like Big Bang sort of that we talk about, where that created the first angel, that they had a lot more power. Because if they had this, if they still had this reality shaping power where they can like unite whole worlds together, like they must have done with the Land of the Dead, then the warfare that we see play out over the course of the rest of the book, it wouldn't play out that way, right? They'd be too powerful to take down.
To really torture the metaphor, they've been going around closing back doors all this time. Yeah. When the system was originally created, the programming had a lot of flaws in it. And now they've been closing back doors, and it's harder and harder to hear through the noise.
They finally installed McAfee or something.
McAfee, I am here to destroy him. We're watching Halt and Catch Fire. I don't know if you can tell by the analogies we're making right now. All right, so that's the Sitch and Hev.
So Sitch and Hev, let's go to the Sitch in the Magisterium. And specifically,
the Consistorial Court of Discipline.
Oh, man.
What a name. Consistorial.
I get annoyed every time I see, because I have to say it in my head.
Yeah.
Like, great, I have to Consistorial Court of Discipline.
And it doesn't like, it's just a fancy way of saying we want to punish people.
Yeah, it's basically the Inquisition.
Yeah.
It's like the Inquisition Committee.
And when you read the other two books that are out currently, they actually figure very bigly. In the second one, yeah. There's a lot of they like recruit young people to be their guard. Basically, you know how you don't because you haven't read it, but you know how in Harry Potter, Umbridge recruits members of her squad to be part of the Inquisitorial squad. basically the consistorial court of discipline does the same thing in schools around England.
Oh man.
Yeah, it's really gross. And I know this has roots in historical whatever, to have like children be the eyes of disobedience. And
yeah, I think probably various surveillance states could use that sort of thing. Yeah. So the consistorial court of discipline, the president is our friend, Hugh MacPhail, a huge fail, huge MacPhail as a
huge fail.
Melissa calls him
huge fail, hug fail, hug fail, hug fail.
The alethiometrist,
another great word,
Fra Pavel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this. They meet in Geneva. These are just little facts. This is a little fact sheet on the consistorial.
Okay.
CCD. So the scene we get is we see Fra Pavel being actively interrogated by the rest of the board. And then afterwards, they kind of all get together and make plans. They make plans to go brigade some subreddits. But before that, they set out a few goals. They want to find the boy, quote unquote, and take control of the knife. They talk about the Oblation Board, which I guess is their biggest rival right now. The Oblation Board, obviously the group that Mrs. Coulter was controlling, the one that oversaw the Bullvanger experiments. Bullvanger experiments, unlike in the show, they're not here described as disasters at all. They were a useful experiment.
Right.
We wish we had thought of it. You know, they kind of beat us to the punch here. Which, considering everything that happened at Bullvanger, is just more evidence of like how these people operate and like just the absolute, you know, inhumanity of them.
It also sets up for the first time the very clear bright line that it's not that the Oblation Board is a offshoot of the consistorial court or the magisterium or whatever. They are directly in competition with the consistorial court.
The Oblation Board sought to understand the effects of dust. We must destroy it altogether. Nothing less than that. If in order to destroy dust, we also have to destroy the Oblation Board, the College of Bishops, every single agency by which the Holy Church does the work of the authority, then so be it. It may be, gentlemen, that the Holy Church itself was brought into being to perform this very task and to perish in the doing of it. But better a world with no church and no dust than a world where every day we have to struggle under the hideous burden of sin. Better a world purged of all that.
And so Father MacPhail references that he feels like the Oblation Board is trying to create its own base of power and become powerful, as powerful as them. And he also differentiates their goals, which is to destroy dust altogether, as opposed to just study it. And like, how are they this short-sighted? And I get that this is like every time we talk about the magisterium, our analogy to incels and 4chan and 8chan and all that stuff, QAnon, like it holds up because they never think past the next step. Like, what's the next step past white supremacy? You don't think past it. You know, it's really terrible, actually. Like, what's if you've achieved your end goal, you're going to wipe out everything that you hold dear, because so many people will be wiped out of use in the economy according to these horrific goals that you send out, and like life and social life will collapse. Like, there's just so many bad effects in the next step. And that's what's happening here with the consistorial court, which is like, we're going to wipe out dust. Well, what do you think is going to happen when you wipe out dust? What will life look like? What will the world, like, will you be able to procreate? Does the world end? Do, you know, zombie free will-less beings who have no dust, does everybody just die and you're in a prison camp forever? Like, think this through.
It kind of sets an expiration date for their dominance. Because, anyway, they're like guaranteeing their own obsolescence over a long enough time period.
Yeah. You know. I mean, it's the same thing as jihadists, right? And as terrorists, like, they really believe that if they achieve their goal, they're going to revert to some idyllic, you know, the martyrdom, the reward forever. And they're so badly deluded. They're so badly deluded.
Yeah.
And it almost makes you feel sad for them, but, you know, they made their choice.
Yeah. It reminds me of the Soviet Union a lot too.
Interesting.
The like, the commitment to obliterating capitalism and obliterating the class structure. And, you know, it's like the class structure is like fundamentally evil. And the only way to free the world from its tyranny is to completely destroy it. And so we're going to spend the next 100 years or so like committing all sorts of horrific violence and atrocity and famine and all the things, all the, you know, generational damage, because we're doing it in the service of eliminating this fundamental evil that has afflicted humanity since its inception. And that is the class structure, you know,
yeah.
And like you see it in Cambodia too, under the Khmer Rouge,
okay.
And you see it in all kinds of places where it's like, if we can just take control of everybody and just force them to live the way we want them to live, damn the consequences. Eventually we will achieve this like idyllic freedom from the sin of capitalism. This is not to say, this is not like an anti-socialism rant. This is just like, this really seems, maybe intentionally, because Philip Pullman would have been a Cold War person, like very similar to the Soviet 20th century idea.
It's all extremes. Like, we can have a little bit of socialism. If we can have a little bit of socialism here, it'd be fine. When you take it too far of an extreme is when things...
Right. It's when you set yourself against, like... progress and just
it's that again stuff. A West Wing scene. The best economic theory is to take a little bit from all the economic theories, and everything in moderation. Well, I think that's all of our dust bears. On to dust bunnies.
I love that we follow up a discussion of the zealotry of the church with a discussion about church members doing occult rituals to summon the living embodiments of abstract concepts like wisdom. What is this church member doing?
This is a great catch. Are you a pagan?
I love it. Hey, I'm all for doing occult rituals to summon this or that. But I just, does your boss know you're doing this? Is this a sanctioned thing you're up to?
Yeah, how is this? But I mean, if you think about prayer in general, they're pretty much all occult rituals, right? Praying for the wisdom of God to come into you, and praying for the Holy Spirit to come down and literally save you from sin, and praying for, boy, we can get really
controversial.
Yeah, but it is all kind of comes from the same thing. But I think maybe the line that makes it feel like a more occult ritual is when there's a physical embodiment that happens right there. You think about you're like sort of like a Buffy thing. Like, you summon something and it appears in a circle. Appears right in a circle that you've drawn on the floor in salt or something. You know?
Yeah, it's wild. You get the sense that the Magisterium is a very high church, you know, like very Catholic in their like rituals and wealth and all that. In the pantheon of the authority and the angels, where does the spirit of wisdom itself fit?
All right, more angel stuff.
Yeah, more angel stuff.
We've talked about it a little bit, but they hold their own particles together by force of will. That's like the best ab workout I ever heard of. They're just going around, consistently working their cores.
Hold
forever. Like, they learn to breathe and walk and eat and do everything while literally holding their body together.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. It's kind of poetic. I love how this aligns with both how we see demons die when they pass on, is like they dissolve into the particles of dust. Mm-hmm. So it's like the same like mechanism.
Sure.
Right. And then also that idea of what we do matter, what we are, spirit. So like, they're willing themselves to be matter.
And this answers the bigger question of how can the little particles be dust and also angels be dust? And it's like, well, they are willing themselves to be an entity.
Yeah.
That's their free will.
Yeah. The very act of being matter is itself an act.
Here's a question.
Yeah.
50 years after this whole series ends, can the particles of Lee Scoresby decide to be an angel?
I would say we get the sense, major spoilers here for the end of the book, that Lee Scoresby's dust particles mix with the dust particles of the whole universe. So it might be hard to like figure out which one is which.
I mean, yes. But if the idea is that you can form yourself into an entity, surely you can, which like each particle is the same as an entity, right? If they're all the same, if they're all made of the same thing.
Yeah.
So could the particles that used to be the body of Lee Scoresby decide, I'm going to find all the other particles that used to be Lee Scoresby and reform myself into an entity out of the free will that I have?
Yeah. And does the very act of seeking immediately call into existence an entity?
Right.
for those dust themselves.
From what we are, spirit, from what we do, matter.
Yeah. The presence of intention implies entity.
Oh, okay. Yeah. This is a dust bunny that turned into a dust bear.
Yeah.
Cool. Ooh. We want to hear your thoughts.
Definitely. We like to call attention to the fact when there's a lot of exposition. I guess that's kind of our bit.
Is it? Is it a bit?
I mean, these books have a lot of exposition.
Good podcast governance. There's some exposition. We're calling it out. But seriously, these particular chapters, lots of exposition. It's almost like off balance. Like it goes two chapters where it's really just a little bit of action. Yeah. And then it's like, here's a world changing bit of exposition.
Yeah, it's like, oh shit, pages. We have to build an entire world because we're going to have to play in this world. I'm just saying, if you wanted to give us a goose, we haven't seen the goose in a while. And we're getting a lot of non-goose exposition. Yeah. Not sure we signed up for that.
I agree. Fra Pavel has an interesting thing to say about the Elite Theometer. It doesn't forecast. It says, if X happens, Y happens. If certain things come about, then the consequences will be. It's basically if this, then that, but in a golden compass shaped, in Elite Theometer shape.
Uh-huh.
So good little note about that.
Yeah, definitely. Very, very important note about how we perceive the Elysiometer.
We have a dust bunny marked as the preemptive penance to talk about that, but I think we talked about that a lot.
I think we did
lot.
Too, yeah.
Boy, is that a troubling...
It sucks, man. It also just shows you how hypocritical this stuff can be. Like, I especially love the fact that they, quote-unquote, invented this doctrine and that they're keeping it to themselves.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, did you? Hey, guys, I just invented a doctrine. I promise it's valid. God told me.
It's called torture.
Yeah,
I'm workshopping the name. Let's think about it more. But I'm thinking of calling it torture. Maybe we'll call it preemptive penance instead. All right, let's go to our lithiometer.
Lithiometer,
hit me.
All right, so my first one is the angel. The angel for its messenger meeting, and this is for Brook, who acts as a messenger of. I guess this one's kind of literal, but Brook tells us some really big stuff. He's an angel who is a messenger. Sometimes you just got to take what's in front of you.
No, that's absolutely. Yeah. Listen, an angel was a key part of this, of these chapters.
The second one is the beehive. And this is a symbol of like work and industry. So it's for the court of discipline. It's for Azrael. It's for everyone. We see a lot of people at work in these chapters. We see a lot of the fruits of their labor, you know, from the oblation board and the court of discipline having this rivalry to Azrael's like giant fortress he's built. That's the beehive. And then I chose the baby for Father Gomez.
Why?
This is a weird one.
Okay.
Because he's been shaped since he was a child. We get the sense with this like malicious intent.
Totally.
And he's retained a very childlike zeal for religion. Like he's clearly not someone who thinks deeply or complexly about the world. Mm-hmm. He's like, he really has like an almost infant like perception of like, this is good. I've been preparing to do this one thing my whole life. I'm going to do it. I'm going to kill this little girl and then I'm going to kill myself and then I'll achieve my thing. And it just reminds me of like a toddler being like, I'm going to get that block and I'm going to play with that block and I'm going to have that block.
Also, he's been so lied to. And so like it's the malleability thing. Yeah. I mean, frankly, my first one is the marionette for him because he's being so manipulated. My opinion is that this is not how you get grace, but it is a key part of his identity. And yeah, he's reprehensible. He's odious. He's all the things, but it also really smacks of him having never had a choice but this.
Yeah. So what are your other two?
I'm going to choose the helmet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Azrael is preparing for war, but in these chapters, a piece of information comes along that really narrows his focus and really changes everything. And so you can only see through the little slit in your helmet.
Visor.
A little visor. He's only seen through the visor. My third one is the owl for fear. Its meanings are night, winter, and fear. And the magisterium is just weeping fear at this point. Fear of their obsolescence, fear that everything that they've been doing has been based on a lie. Spoiler alert, it is. And, you know, they're acting out of fear, which is where you get the kind of execrable actions they are doing.
Yeah, execrable.
It's a good word, hard
to
say.
It is. It's like the internecine of this week.
He's got internecine. I've got execrable. I'm jealous of his. All right. Extra award.
Extra award. So I picked Father McHuge Fail.
Huge Fail.
He's just like, if you just took a beat, if you just relax, like, listen, the oblation board's going to oblation. Let them do their thing.
Oblation board going
to
oblate.
Yeah. You don't need to like kill this girl. Just let her do her thing. We can all have a fall. It's okay. We're fallible people. Like, he would be overweight, but he's so, like,
that's,
works out
that
so
was
hard.
A weird sentence. He would be fat. How do you know he would be fat? I don't understand.
It was a weird sentence.
It was a weird sentence. Like he's like, does Philip Pullman believe that people are genetically assigned to their sizes and that it's only overcomable by incredible, incredible...
Maybe that,
know.
That, like, his working out hasn't yielded, like, a powerful or an athletic body. He just looks, like, gaunt and kind of, like...
Or maybe he was, like, chubby as a kid or something, and that he's, like, genetically predisposed. It was a weird sin. Get more protein, get those sick gains going. I got some TikToks I can show you.
Ease up on the cardio and just...
gotta lay off that
take
cardio.
Take a nap, man. Yeah.
In terms of job stability, what he's doing is so dumb. He could let everybody fall... into a state of sin, and then you have your job forever. You're fine. Yeah. My extra award is for Baruch. The effort to fight off four angels, get to where you're going, literally hold your body together as long as you can so that you can get, I mean, however sarcastic and kind of ill-tempered these angels were, they really were trying to do what was right, and hats off to you.
Totally. He's like, well, into the cloud of burning sulfur I go.
Exactly. It's like, oh, crap. Well, okay. Just chin up. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And he gets through and he fights off four angels. He kills two of them, I believe, or it results in their death.
Yeah.
And he like literally does his core workout as long as he can until somebody comes along and, you know, the guy in the gym drops one of those big weights off in the corner and it jumped and it scares you and you and you lose your concentration and then he died.
And then he died.
Yeah. Hey, it's mixtape time.
Oh man, it's mixtape time.
I don't have any bangers this week.
No
bangers.
My bangers, banger
they
free.
Are, listen, they have to come when they're important.
I think you bring a banger when you feel a banger is needed. Listen, it's not the bangers we want, it's the bangers we need.
There we go.
Okay, the first one is a different look this week. It is Modest Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain. The classic classical piece.
Clearly.
20th century Russian piece. I think 20th century. So those of you who have watched Fantasia will recognize this piece as the piece at the end of Fantasia when the mountain turns into like a dragon demon thing.
Spoiler
More
alert.
Like a demon. Yeah. If you haven't seen the 1920s Fantasia. To me, this represents both what's going on in heaven with Metatron and the clouded mountain, this like giant heaven-sized mountain of clouds that's going to be turned into an engine of war, and Baruch's just epic Miltonian struggle between him fighting off the four angels across the vast pit of liquid sulfur with the fumes and the flames rising. I listen to it, man. It'll probably be the first time a lot of you have heard it since, you know, you watched Fantasia as a kid and just picture those angels struggling above this
cool
hellish landscape.
Very cool.
So my second one is for Balthamos and Baruch. Mm. It's Lucy Rose's Shiver.
We broke everything that was right. We both enjoyed a good fight. And we sold all the holes we had to breathe to make the other one leave.
The lyrics are like not exactly a line, but it's like, it's the saddest, beautiful love song I could think of. Mm. The music video for it is literally too sad to watch, but it's beautifully done. It's like footage of this old guy, like walking and exploring this like beach town in, it looks like England somewhere, interspersed with this like very old school video footage of this like beautiful, like 20 something woman in like the same locations. So clearly like he took this video like 60 years ago and mm-hmm. now he's like revisiting this place mm-hmm. with this, you know, it's so sad and so beautiful. It's like, you can't even deal with it.
Wow.
But yeah, so I just thought this is a good song for Baruch and Balthamos and their wonderful doomed love affair. No bangers here.
And again, we want to hear all your thoughts at extraneouspod@gmail.com or just get us on one of our social things. Extraneouspod on Twitter, extraneous.pod on Instagram.
Check out patreon.com/makingmischief. Oh, yeah,
we have a Patreon. If you would like to hear more of our stuff, please go ahead and go there.
Yeah, mischiefmedia.com, mischiefmerch.com. One thing else.
Always one thing. There's always just that one thing at the end. I can't quite remember what it is.
That's
Stay extra.
Yeah.